The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, an article entitled, Black Holes Swallow Everything, Even the Truth, by Marina Corin. In 1967, the physicist John Wheeler was giving a lecture about a mysterious and startling phenomenon in deep space that the field was just beginning to understand. But it didn't have a great name to match. Wheeler and his audience were equally tired of hearing gravitational completely collapsed object over and over, so someone threw out an idea for a different name. A few weeks later, at another conference, Wheeler debuted the suggestion, black hole. And it's perfect, isn't it? What else would you call an abyss that swallows light and matter and doesn't let go? Decades later, black holes, invisible, impenetrable, and many light years away, are more familiar to us than ever before. We know that supermassive versions sit at the center of most galaxies, including our own Milky Way. In 2019, we even got pictures that show a black hole as an imposing shadow against a glow of cosmic material. Scientists have detected the gravitational ripples that result when black holes smash into each other. The entire cosmos, we recently learned, might be humming with the force of such collisions. The list goes on. But the big mystery still remains. We don't know what lies at the center of a black hole, beyond the boundary where matter winks out of view forever. The question is definitely answerable in that someone could fall inside the black hole and find out the answer. Elliot Quatert, a theoretical astrophysicist at Princeton, told me in an email. The problem is they couldn't convey that answer to someone outside the black hole, because nothing can get out. Because such hands-on observation is impossible, scientists must approach the subject theoretically. The effort involves mind-bending physics calculations, endless thought experiments, and seriously entertaining the possibility that the universe is delightfully weirder than we can imagine. It also requires accepting that we'll never truly know for sure what's inside a black hole. For us Earthlings, a bottomless pit more massive than the sun might be difficult to fathom. Black holes are not solid objects like planets or asteroids, Shane Larson, a physics professor at Northwestern University, told me. They're more like regions in space, seemingly empty spots made noticeable by the stars orbiting wildly around them. It's kind of like an open window, Larson said, an invisible line that separates exterior from interior. To understand why black holes scramble our understanding of cosmic forces, we need to think about their structure. If a black hole were a Ferrero Rocher chocolate ball, the first layer of chocolate and the crushed hazelnuts would be the region just outside the event horizon, where gravity is still weak enough that a nearby star could safely whiz by and not fall in. Next up is a layer of crispy wafer. This is the event horizon, the point of no return. Under this layer lies smooth chocolate filling through which trapped cosmic material is sucked toward the center. And then there's the heart of the Ferrero candy, the whole roasted hazelnut. This is the singularity, a tiny concentrated point of infinite density. Physicists believe that they understand what the space beyond the event horizon, nearly all the way through the chocolate filling, should look like, based on Einstein's theory of general relativity. If an astronaut were to fall into a black hole, she would descend, and as she went deeper, she would experience the very fabric of space-time warping all around her. The 1915 theory describes well what must occur in such an extreme environment, where gravity overwhelms all other forces in the universe. The trouble starts farther in, closer to the singularity, where the laws of physics as we currently understand them break down, Larson said. Deep inside a black hole, general relativity isn't enough to explain what's happening. You also need a different kind of physics, quantum mechanics, which deals with the tiniest particles of the universe, atoms and their even smaller components. When collapsing all matter down to a point, as a black hole does, the size gets small enough that quantum effects become important. James Miller Jones, an astronomer at Curtin University in Australia, told me in an email. Unfortunately, general relativity and quantum mechanics do not get along. According to the principles of general relativity, once stuff goes into a black hole, it's lost for good. You can determine some fundamental properties of the black hole, such as its mass, but not its constituent parts. In the 1970s, Stephen Hawking showed that black holes actually evaporate very slowly, emitting radiation from just outside the event horizon. This development should have been thrilling for quantum mechanics, which dictates that information can't be destroyed. If someone took apart a completed puzzle and scattered it around your garden, you could collect the pieces and put them together again, Nicholas Warner, a physicist and astronomy professor at the University of Southern California, told me. It would take some time and effort without a picture to guide you, but quantum theory says you could do it. But the particles wafting off black holes seem entirely devoid of information about the contents of their interior, a clear-cut violation of that principle. It's as if someone had run all those puzzle pieces through a washing machine, and they all became this gloopy gray mess, Warner said. Theoretical physicists around the world are trying to reconcile the mismatch between general relativity and quantum mechanics. Warner is a member of the camp that believes that Einstein's theory, the very principles that predicted the existence of black holes before astronomers found evidence of them, is incomplete. Other experts feel the same, but say Einstein isn't the only one to blame. Maybe you have to change quantum mechanics, too, David Harlow, a physicist at MIT, told me. Harlow and his colleagues have posited that the radiation that Hawking discovered is indeed encoded with information from the depths, and our understanding of quantum mechanics isn't good enough yet to unscramble it. Everyone is searching for a theory of quantum gravity that avoids any contradiction. We don't have one of those, Charles Haley, an astrophysicist at Columbia University, told me. Not even close. But some physicists I spoke with said the field could crack it within decades, certainly in this century. Scientists would finally know, but only in the theoretical sense, of course. That's the thing about black holes. We can get only so close to the truth, only experience certain kinds of knowing. Even the powerful telescopes that have shown us sparkling galaxies near all the way back to the Big Bang can't help us here. Observationally, we're almost certainly not going to learn anything about the inside of black holes in this century, Carl Rodriguez, a physics professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told me in an email. The best we can do is to study some effects of black holes. Maya Fischbach, an astrophysicist at the University of Toronto, thinks we'll learn more by studying the invisible gravitational waves that fan out when two black holes collide and merge into one. Those waves carry with them information about the newly formed black hole, which vibrates in the aftermath of its creation like a bell. Just like listening to a ringing bell can tell us what the bell is made of, listening to the black hole ringing can tell us what the black hole is made of, Fischbach told me. But the purest form of discovery will always remain out of reach. If no means a student could take a field trip, observe directly with their own senses, then come back and write a class report about what they observed, then we will never know what is inside, Larson said. Perhaps that's not the worst thing. If it were easy to encounter situations like that, environments with extreme drag you into the abyss gravity, it would probably be bad for us, Harlow said. Safer to study black holes from afar, in our quiet cosmic neighborhood, where gravity is far weaker and we overcome it each day, simply by pulling back the covers and getting out of bed in the morning. Our next article is entitled America's Original Gun Control. Early in our history, firearm laws were everywhere. By Robert J. Spitzer. In the summer of 1619, the leaders of the fledgling Jamestown colony came together as the first General Assembly to enact, quote, just laws for the happy guiding and governing of the people there inhabiting, quote, end quote, consisting of the governor, Sir George Yeardley, his four counselors, and 22 elected burgesses or representatives. The group approved more than 30 measures. Among them was the nation's first gun law, that no man do sell or give any Indians any piece, shot, or powder, or any other arms offensive or defensive, upon pain of being held a traitor to the colony and of being hanged as soon as the fact is proved, without all redemption. After that early example of gun control came many more laws placing restrictions on the ownership and use of firearms. If guns have always been a part of American society, so have gun laws. This fact might come as a surprise to some gun rights advocates who seem to believe that America's past was one of unregulated gun ownership. That view received a big assist in 2022 when the Supreme Court declared in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association Incorporated versus Bruin that the constitutionality of modern gun laws depends on whether they are, quote, consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, end quote. In other words, the constitutional standard for any modern gun law boils down to whether you can find a good precedent for it back in the 1700s or 1800s. The advocate's assumption is that such precedents are few and far between, but thanks to the work of researchers and the digitization of archival material, thousands of old gun laws of every imaginable variety are now available for reference. Far from being exceptional in American history, gun control regulations are the default. If Bruin was designed to nullify the constitutional basis, for many gun laws, it ought to fail. Because of the constant conflict between indigenous people and European settlers in the early colonial period, virtually every colony enacted laws similar to Jamestown's to keep firearms out of the hands of hostiles, ineffective as the laws generally were. Over the two centuries that followed and up to the Civil War, the pervasive fear of enslaved persons' rebellion prompted many colonies and later states to enact laws to prevent their obtaining guns. Gun regulations in the antebellum period, however, were not at all about bans. At least 11 states enacted licensing laws that allowed, usually under some form of supervision, enslaved people and free black people to carry weapons. Throughout this long period in the history of the Republic, up until the beginning of the 20th century, gun laws placed conditions or restrictions on weapons access for a wide variety of citizens, in particular indentured servants, vagrants, non-Protestants, those who refused to swear an oath of loyalty to the government, felons, foreigners, minors, and those under the influence of alcohol. Numerous laws regulated hunting practices as well as firearms carry, use, storage, and transportation, regulated the manufacture, inspection, storage, and sale of firearms, imposed gun licensing, and restricted dangerous or unusual weapons. Despite the Thomas opinion's claim that the historical record yields relatively few 18th and 19th century sensitive places where weapons were altogether prohibited, some local authorities outlawed the discharge of firearms in or near towns, buildings, or roads, as well as after dark, on Sundays, at public gatherings, and in cemeteries. In some jurisdictions, any use of firearm that wasted gunpowder was also an offense. A typical penalty for violations of these laws was some combination of a fine and imprisonment. In the 1700s and 1800s, the period of principal interest to the justices because of the Second Amendment's adoption in 1791 and the addition of the 14th Amendment in 1868, a breach of gun carry and hunting laws could also have resulted in confiscation. Naturally, some of these laws addressed problems unique to their time. Concerns about conserving gunpowder, for example, were important from the 1600s to the mid-1800s because its relative scarcity made it a precious substance that was dangerous to keep on hand in any quantity and soon degraded if not properly stored or handled. Other types of laws, though, corresponded much more directly to modern gun regulations. Take the matter of carrying of firearms and other dangerous weapons in public. As early as 1686, New Jersey enacted a law against anyone who presumed, quote, privately to wear any pocket pistol, skeins, stilettos, daggers, or dirks, or other unusual or unlawful weapons, because they induced great fear and quarrels. This law also warned the gentry against what we would now call open carry. Quote, no planter shall ride or go armed with sword, pistol, or dagger upon the penalty. New Hampshire passed a law in 1744 penalizing any unlawful assembly of a dozen or more persons being armed with clubs or other weapons, including firearms, that refused to disperse. Massachusetts followed suit in 1751. Virginia and North Carolina passed similar laws against the open carry weapons in 1786 and 1792, respectively. In the post-revolution 1800s, as rising violent crime led more people to arm themselves, a total of 42 states, plus the District of Columbia, enacted laws against concealed carry. Three more did so in the early 1900s, so that the total included almost every state in the Union. As many states from the 1700s to 1900s also enacted some form of weapons licensing law. That's not all. Over the same period, at least 22 states restricted any gun carrying, including of long guns. Moreover, across the entire period, three-quarters of the states had laws either against brandishing, waving a gun around in a menacing or threatening manner, or merely having a weapon on display in public. For modern Americans, concealed carry is synonymous with toting a handgun. But in the 1700s and 1800s, a time when single-shot pistols were unreliable and inaccurate, fighting knives were a major concern. The most infamous of these was the Bowie knife, named after Jim Bowie, who reputedly killed one man and wounded another using, quote, a big knife, end quote, given to him by his brother, Resin Bowie, in a fight in 1827. Bowie-related mythology was magnified by the adventurer's death at the Alamo in Texas in 1836, which fanned demand for the knife, and also spurred the enactment of laws against its carry. In the 1830s, at least six states passed such laws. By the century's end, every state but one restricted Bowie knives. Another example of a new technology or design that prompted legislation was the trap gun. This was a contraption intended to deter trespassers, poachers, or thieves that was rigged to cause a firearm to go off, usually triggered by a string or wire. A 1771 New Jersey law criminalized the setting of, quote, any loaded gun in such a manner as that the same shall be intended to go off or discharge itself, or be discharged by any string, rope, or other contrivance, end quote. At least 17 other states enacted anti-trap gun laws from the 1850s to the early 1900s. As best I can determine, trap guns' use was relatively rare, but incidents involving them received considerable less press attention. A Bangor, Maine newspaper reported on October 27, 1870, that a burglar who broke into a New York City shop had, quote, the top of his head blown off, end quote, by a trap gun. A few such incidents are needed to teach the thieves who have lately been operating in this city a lesson, opined the periodical. But most contemporary commentary supported anti-trap gun laws because of the risk that innocent people could be injured or killed, and because of a revulsion against such vigilante-style justice. By the end of the 19th century, America was changing dramatically, becoming a majority urban nation. That shift to an individual metropolitan society coincided with the mass production and increased circulations of ever cheaper and more reliable handguns, leading to a rise in homicides and other gun crimes. The new century was also marked by the advent of modern policing, with greater capabilities to address these growing problems. This development was reflected in a new generation of gun laws aiming to tackle the challenges of public order and safety in American cities. Thus, New York's Sullivan Act, a major provision of which was struck down in the Bruin ruling, came into force in 1911, the year that gave John Browning's famous semi-automatic pistol design its name. What does this long record amount to? For a start, America's actual gun carry law history collides with its gun mythology. The guns were widely carried and largely unregulated until the rise of the regulatory state in the 20th century. No question, gun ownership is as old as the country, though less widespread and unfettered than our folklore suggests, but so are gun laws. In addition, even though for much of its history America was an agrarian country, the modern nation-state still in the making, with local governments that possessed few resources and limited power, its lawmakers and enforcers were inventive and determined about ensuring public safety. When they perceived a threat to that order from firearms, they passed laws to restrict or prevent them. And back then, by and large, no court struck down those laws. That is what is truly consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. So, if we accept the original premise of Bruin, the actual results should be to render a broad array of gun regulations constitutional. Next, Don't Wish for Happiness, Work for It, by Arthur C. Brooks. In his 1851 work, American Notebooks, Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote, "Happiness in this world, when it comes, comes incidentally. Make it the object of pursuit, and it leads us a wild goose chase, and is never attained." This is basically a restatement of the Stoic philosopher's paradox of happiness. To attain happiness, we must not try to attain it. A number of scholars have set out to test this claim. For example, researchers writing in the journal Emotion in 2011 found that valuing happiness was associated with lower moods, less well-being, and more depressive symptoms under conditions of low life stress. At first, this would seem to be to support the happiness paradox, that thinking about it makes it harder to get. But there are alternative explanations. For example, unhappy people might say they value happiness more than those who already possess it, just as hungry people value food more than those who are full. More to the point, wishing you were happier does not mean that you are working to improve your happiness. Think of your friend who complains about her job every day but never tries to find a new one. No doubt she wishes she were happier, but for whatever reason she doesn't do the work to improve her circumstances. This is not evidence that she can't become happier or that her wishes are bringing her down. In truth, happiness requires effort, not just desire. Focusing on your dissatisfaction and wishing things were different in your life is a recipe for unhappiness if you don't take action to put yourself on a better path. But if you make an effort to understand human happiness, formulate a plan to apply what you learn to your life, execute on it, and share what you learn with others, happiness will almost surely follow. When it comes to happiness and unhappiness, people often confuse rumination with self-awareness. Psychologists define the former as recursive self-focused thinking. It is to dwell on something about yourself without recourse to new knowledge. Many studies show that rumination can exacerbate bad emotions and deepen depression because it reinforces your negative emotional status quo. In contrast, self-awareness, to be attentive to our own thinking processes, leads to new knowledge and breakthroughs. One recent study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concluded that self-awareness allows us to recognize emotional cues and distractions and to redirect our minds in productive ways. In essence, studying your own mind and pondering ways to improve your happiness takes inchoate or just begun anxieties and mental meandering and transforms them into real plans for life improvement. Rumination is to be stuck. Self-reflection is to seek to be unstuck. The trick, of course, is telling the difference. Say you have just experienced a breakup. If you go over the painful circumstances again and again, like watching a looped video for hours and days, this is rumination. To break out of the cycle and begin the process of self-reflection, you'd have to follow the painful memory with insightful questions. For example, is this a recurring pattern in my life? If so, why? If I could do it over again, what would I do differently? What can I read to help inform me more about what I have just experienced and use it constructively? Self-reflection moves feelings of unhappiness from our reactive brains to our executive brains, where we can manage them through complete action, concrete action. The action itself is crucial. There is an old joke about a man who asks God every day to let him win the lottery. After many years of this prayer, he finally gets an answer from heaven. "Do me a favor," says God, "buy a ticket." If you want happiness, reflecting on why you don't have it and seeking information on how to attain it is a good start. But if you don't use that information, you're not buying a ticket. Once you've reflected, not ruminated, learned, taken action, and reaped the happy rewards, it's time to make sure the benefits are not temporary, that you don't fall back into simply wishing. The key is sharing your new knowledge with other people. Teaching arithmetic problems to others has been shown to improve people's ability to solve them. And in my experience, the same is true for the study of happiness. Sharing knowledge cements it in your own mind. One of the most important assignments I give my graduate students is for them to talk about the science and art of happiness at every party they go to. This ensures that they have the ideas clear enough in their heads to explain them to others. Sharing the secrets of happiness will make you happier because doing so is an act of love. As we have all seen, love is generative. The more you give it, the more of it you get. I tremble at the thought of contradicting Hawthorne and the Stoics, but it is not true that pursuing happiness must lead to a wild goose chase, or that thinking about happiness makes it more elusive. Like everything else in life that is worthwhile, pursuing happiness requires intellectual energy and real effort. You simply have to do the work. The good news is that the work will be joyful, and the results quite wonderful. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast on our website, on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.